Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Matt Scalisi, editor of FilmNerds.com. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films.
Hello, Matt.
What's up, man?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good, because several days ago, I watched the movie La La Land, and that movie makes you feel good. What did you think of it?
I was just sort of head over heels as soon as I finished watching it, and I really have not stopped thinking about it. I probably saw it a week ago now, or close to it, and it's one of those that has stuck with me in a big way, and it's going to be hard to unseat it. I mean, as my favorite movie of the year, I think. I definitely haven't had this strong of an emotional response to a movie in 2016.
Yeah, it's a movie that I remember reading about it, and I haven't seen Whiplash, so I wasn't sure, you know, really what to think. But it sounded like a neat idea. And then I saw the first trailer for it, and I was like, well, this is certainly going to be something that I need to take my wife to, being a fan of musical theater and dance and all these other things. So I made sure I kind of kept my eye on the release date, and then I started seeing it get some awards and stuff and a lot of buzz. But I try to keep my expectations measured, you know. But I'll be honest, within, like, I don't know, 40 seconds of this movie, maybe less, I was like, I think I love this, and I'm trying not to. I was trying so hard to, like, keep my critical hat on, where, you know, I was like, you know, I was second guessing my reaction to it, because I was like, no, I've just been hyped up or, you know, whatever. But every time, you know, I got preoccupied for even a second with that, the movie kept pulling me back in. The craft kept pulling me back in. And by the end of it, I had just been on this roller coaster of like, I can't believe how much I love this. And there's no reason to think that I wouldn't have, but I agree. I mean, it blew me away. It's my favorite film of the year. It, like you said, it's a movie that I keep thinking about. I never would have expected it to be as emotionally complex as it is. You know, it's a movie that it's a feel good movie in a lot of ways, but not immediately. You know, like when you first. Spoilers, by the way. Let's go ahead and do that. When I first walked out of the theater, I had a little bit of this bittersweet feeling where I was like, was that all great, and then I just don't like the end, or is the end brilliant? And I've kind of come around to the point that no, this is an incredibly mature romantic movie. You know, embraces romance and takes romance back from, you know, a cynical world, but then says romance is great and all these things, but you know, there's more to life than that, you know, and sometimes romance is a launching point to something else, to a different stage of your life, and it's not the forever mode, you know, and I feel like that is a very grown up way to look at this.
I think this movie in a lot of ways is about sort of defining those concepts and playing with the edges of them in a way that, you know, firstly, I think the fact that it's exploring those themes in the genre of a classic Hollywood musical is sort of brilliant in and of itself, because this is a genre. And it's not this. There's a very big difference, I think, between this movie and the sort of new generation of musicals that we are used to seeing, even the ones that have been Oscar nominated, the, you know, Dreamgirls and Hairspray and things like that. The you know, Bill Condon big flashy musicals that I think are very much made for a contemporary audience. this is a movie that uses the musical genre as a historical reference point in a lot of ways. I'm making it sound so academic, and it does not feel that way when you watch it. But these are things that have occurred to me since seeing it. And it is, I think that that genre of movie that this movie is calling back to was built on very, you know, I think a lot of people would say sort of unrealistic, but certainly fantastical, you know, ideas of romance and sort of, you know, I guess beyond just male, female, you know, sexual attraction romance, more like the romance of Hollywood, the romance of, you know, being a jazz musician, and these, these ideas of, you know, the sort of romanticized versions of certain concepts in America. And I think this movie both, you know, I think at first it starts off showing us a bunch of characters who are fully wrapped up in that romance. And then they start to see those ideas fall apart in front of them, and the romance wears off. And then the brilliant thing that you absolutely aren't expecting in a movie made in 2016 is that the final act of this movie then says, you know what, actually, there is some romance, some of this, but it may not look exactly like what you thought it was going to look like, and it might be a little different, and it might play out differently than you thought it would. But great things can come from being a romantic and from being an idealist. And if you allow yourself to sort of see the nuance and see the, you know, accept things for how they are, you know, with all the good and bad, then you can actually, it's okay to be a romantic in some aspects. And I think that is the last act of the movie really, really hit me hard. And had a huge effect on me because, like you said, there is a maturity to it, but in a way, I think it also fights back against the side of us that wants to embrace cynicism and call that maturity.
Right, exactly. That's the thing. That's why I said maturity. I think there, you know, maturity is almost uniformly constructive, I think, but, you know, cynicism is almost destructive. And yeah, there's also something else here where that just occurred to me that, you know, these people are wrapped up in a romance, you know, with their art, with their chosen art form, and with each other eventually. But in both cases, they're in these kind of stages where it kind of they're stuck. You know, it's less of a passion and more of an obsession in a way, and it's not until they give up something, you know, if they give of themselves, that it kind of brings their passion to life, both for their work and for each other and for other people. And, you know, they're actually able to love you know, more people. So I think there's something really interesting there too, where you know, it explores the necessity of an artist to sacrifice, you know, and how damaging it is when everything's about you as the creator.
It's fascinating that you say that, and I know that you have not seen Whiplash, and I don't want to go too into it because I don't want to spoil it for you. Whiplash is a movie that I felt as bad after watching Whiplash as I felt good after watching this movie. And it is a movie that definitely explores the theme of artists making sacrifices. But, man, does it come at it from a different angle and end up in a very different place than this movie does. And that's probably for another podcast. I don't know. But I think, you know, From a thematic standpoint, it works so well, and it lands, it point, I think, so incredibly effectively. It's a sign of great writing and great directing. But from, I do want to talk to you about the technical parts of this movie.
Yeah, I mean,
it transcendent. I mean, it is an incredibly unique looking. I mean, unique, but also, of course, it's calling back to a lot of things from before. It's just, man, is this an awesome movie to just look up at on a giant screen?
Yeah, I mean, we keep talking about, you know, I guess it's good. We're talking about the substance of the movie first and the character and themes and all that stuff. But, I mean, throw all that in the garbage can and you still have this just technical marvel. You know, I mean, this is the way these sequences are put together. Not a hair is out of place. It's all, as far as I can tell, I'm sure there's a lot of trickery going on, but it all looks like it's in camera. It looks at its long takes of, you know, of choreography and performance. And it's the most technically staggering movie of the year. You know, I mean, Captain America Civil War had this incredible, you know, multi-character action scene in it. And honestly, this is more impressive in terms of set pieces.
We're such dorks, Ben, because I actually came home and talked to my wife about it and said, my first thing I said was, well, there's a scene in this movie that surpasses the Captain America airport fight for me. And she's like, well, that says a lot coming from you.
Yeah, I mean, but it's true. There's, I don't even know if I could point to one sequence in this movie that does that. It's just every number has, every musical number has its little thing, you know?
I can tell you what it was for me for sure. Although, the first, it's actually the second musical number of the movie, but it's the first one where we're basically introduced to Emma Stone's character singing and kind of what her world is. But the one where she's getting ready and going to this party,
yeah,
is awesome. But also, to me, the highlight of the movie is the last musical number, and it really is.
The montage. You mean the montage of everything happening again, kind of.
It's technically, I've been listening to the soundtrack a good bit since I saw this movie, but it's called the epilogue on the soundtrack.
Yep.
But it calls back to all the other songs in the movie and visually calls back to all the other scenes, the key scenes in the movie, and it calls back to them in a sort of staged theatrical way, which is, I had actually just recently rewatched Singing in the Rain, and it's very similar to the last musical number in Singing in the Rain also, where they're sort of playing with the ideas of, you know, Hollywood artifice, but they sort of play it up and make it even, you know, bigger scale than it was originally, than the first time you saw it.
An expressionist kind of approach.
Yeah, it's incredible, man. It's such a great sequence. And it's also the emotional high point of the movie, too. There's so much going on, and it's all sort of taking place inside the mind of Emma Stone's character. And there's so much communicated without a single line of dialogue. And, I mean, it's just so incredibly well done and pulled off. And it's also cool because at that point in the movie, it's actually been a while since there's been any songs, since there's been any musical numbers. So they've kind of taken us through this big, long stretch of a dramatic movie, and then they fling us back into fantasy again. And I feel like it's sort of this roller coaster all of a sudden.
That is something that I think is noteworthy. It doesn't abandon the musical format, but it does kind of shift gears a little bit in the last act. And then even then, it's not like it ever comes back to, you know, a song and dance duet kind of thing, which I didn't realize until I was thinking about the movie. And I think I've seen a few bits of criticism about that it didn't kind of stick to its guns or something. But I think that misunderstands what the movie's trying to do. It's not trying to be a specifically, you know, structured MGM type musical. It's it's taking that and going, you know, that'd be like complaining about, you know, whatever, Pulp Fiction
I
not
think,
having the right amount of action scenes or something like that.
And I think the fact that they set off different segments, basically the different acts of the movie with title cards, is pretty clear that they intend for these segments of the movie to feel very different, and they do.
They're
set up as pieces, and they all feel quite different. The different seasons of the movie are, you know, they take us on this arc that, you know, you definitely feel like you've been through something by the end of it.
Yeah, and they're all color-coded, I noticed. Like, at the beginning of each sequence, each season, like a common color that kind of pops up. I noticed, I think, in the springtime, she's wearing a yellow dress, and there's a bunch of yellow everywhere. And then in the summertime, I think it's, like, purple, and there's, like, these purple trash cans that are walking around. I don't know how consistent it is, but it's little touches like that where I kept noticing stuff where I was like, God, oh, my God, this is, like, so intricately put together, and yet still it doesn't feel like a, you know, a technical exercise. It's still so human and so alive. It's a frustrating movie to watch because it's so exquisitely put together. And I believe Damien Chazelle is younger than us.
I'm excited for you to watch Whiplash and hear what you think about it. I definitely remain very frustrated about that movie, and I don't find it enjoyable, but I certainly can't deny that I would never say that the filmmaker didn't know what he was doing. I think he had full control. I didn't want to go where he wanted to go
in that movie. Yeah.
And I think now, looking at his body of work between that movie and this, I can without question say he is one of the most, you know, interesting, compelling filmmakers out there. And maybe toss in, too, that he wrote one of my other favorite movies of the year, 10 Cloverfield Lane, which is also an extremely well thought out movie that, you know, this is a guy who I think, while he is, you know, he has a unique artistic voice, I think that he actually cares about whether he's alienating the audience or not. He might even want to sometimes, but I think he's aware of it. I think he's aware of how he's affecting the audience. And, you know, to me, that separates him from, you know, what I would sort of label as an art house director. I think this is a guy who is trying to engage with the audience in a very direct way.
Yeah. I mean, his next movie is about Neil Armstrong, from what I understand. So I think you see just from that trajectory from Whiplash to, which, you know, and Whiplash and La La Land are both about performers. So, yeah, there is intrinsically, you know, an audience-minded element to both movies. But then also, yeah, just the pop entertainment that 10 Cloverfield Lane is. And then, of course, such a public figure such as Neil Armstrong. I definitely think he has an ambition to connect with many people, and I don't think he's going to be going. He's not Nicholas Winding Refn, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, that's the perfect example of what I use the term art house director. The other thing, Jen, that I wanted to mention, that actually from having re-listened to the soundtrack after seeing the movie, I actually walked out of it, one of probably the only negative I had, if you can call it that, was that the songwriting itself didn't really click with me when I was watching it on my first, you know, impression.
Like the lyrics, you mean?
Yeah, and I mean, I loved the music, actually, and I thought that the music and the movie itself were a lot better than the lyrical content of the songs in the movie, but... Hang on one second. Sorry. Hey, I'm doing an FNU real quick. Doing a podcast. I'll see you at home real quick. Almost done. I drove past my family on our street. walking the dog. So
walk
anyway.
Out of the house.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm gonna reset real quick.
Yep.
But yeah, the songs didn't really click with me. I don't know if they just maybe weren't right on the nose. I actually don't know who wrote the songs. I get the impression that John Legend was involved with the songwriting and the music, but I'm speaking from ignorance in terms of who the actual songwriter was. But they didn't totally, the lyrics on most of the songs, and there's a few exceptions, didn't really associate for me with what was going on in the movie. And now that I've re-listened to it, I have to say that maybe my sound quality wasn't great in the theater, but they actually worked a lot better as I re-listened, especially the opening song, which really didn't make sense to me when I was watching it. I was more taken with the choreography and the visuals, but you know, they're really all kind of singing about that this, they kind of set the stage for this idea that the two characters in the movie that we're following are kind of two of a million people in the same mm-hmm. city who are all basically going through the same arc. They're all there because they have probably somewhat unrealistic dreams of grandeur, and they're, you know, hacking away at it every day trying to make it work, and it's not working yet. And, you know, I think that's a really cool, it actually is a song I think that works better after you've already seen the movie all the way through.
Yeah, yeah, it's just a great, like, little introductory number, you know, one of those ensemble pieces that kick off so many musicals. I have a question, a music question. You know more about classical music than me, I think.
Hardly anything at all, but go ahead.
Well, is any of this music based on anything or sourced from anything?
I don't think so. And the main tune, which I kind of, when you watch the movie, it's the most story significant little piece of music.
Yes.
It's a little piano thing.
Yeah.
I think we kind of, when you watch it, you feel like it must be some classical piece, but it's not. It's actually an original piece of music for the movie, and it's called Mia and Sebastian's theme.
Right.
So it's just this cool little, you know, sad classical sounding thing, and they go through different iterations of it in the movie that fit the mood of that, you know, portion of the movie. I really like, there are two or three themes that kind of reverberate song.
The reason I brought it up is because the theme from the planetarium is, I mean, that just sounds like something, you know, that we've been listening to for centuries. Like, it's just like so so awesome and beautiful.
Well,
that music is actually
used several times in the other songs. It kind of shows up and you
right.
hear echoes of
mm-hmm.
it in the other songs. It's really cool what they did, and after you see the movie, I would definitely recommend listening to the score all the way through, because there's some cool things that are going on in terms of how they sort of use and reuse certain little pieces of music.
Yeah, I've been listening to it an awful lot, but not necessarily in like one sitting all the way through. So I've been kind of piecemealing it. So I need to sit and kind of, you know, absorb all the motifs and patterns and everything like that. And I mean, just if nothing else, just a way to re-experience the movie, because it is a movie. Like, I kind of feel like other people probably felt about Avatar, you know, where I just like, man, on a bad day, I might just hit the theater up and go see this movie again if it's still playing. You know,
I definitely
just,
want to see it again, and
I'm literally on cloud nine.
Yeah, it definitely does feel like it's transporting you a little bit, and I think it's just because we don't get to see movies like this very often, and some of it too is probably, you know, the larger world outside and the time that this movie arrived. I think it's very timely, and I think it's affecting audiences, you know, right now because of when it's coming out and what's going on for a lot of people too. So.
You mentioned something in a text, and you can expound on this as much as you'd like or as little as you'd like. You mentioned something in text about it kind of being an interesting microcosm for America and pragmatism and all these things. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I don't want to get overly political on
sure.
FNU, but I do think that for me, one thing I took from it was I feel like this has been a year when a lot of people have not just sort of eschewed idealism, but downright kind of mocked the very idea of it and sort of said, hey, look, you know, none of this actually means anything anymore. Let's just do the thing that gets us the result we want, and that's all we actually care about. You know, go play music that you hate and stop complaining about it. You never, you know, people don't want to listen to what kind of music you want to make anymore. So grow up and go do something that pays your bills. You know, and I think this is a movie that without doing the sort of like Cameron Crowe ridiculous childish idealism says, you know what, you can actually do great things that you care about and that make you happy and inspire other people, and you don't have to be, that doesn't mean that you're a child, that doesn't mean that you're invalid somehow, you know. I think it's a movie that's about the value of idealism and you know, and romanticism and the fact that there should actually be beauty that we embrace, and we, you know, it doesn't have to be pure pragmatism. It doesn't always just have to be about getting the bills paid. To me, that was a theme of especially the back half of 2016, people just saying, you know what, all this stuff that you care about and the things you stand up for and get passionate about, you're just fooling yourself, you know. And I think it's great that this is a movie that says, you know, you're not, it's okay, you're not fooling yourself. These are okay things to care about and get fired up about.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, on so many levels, it's a inspirational and, for me, affirming movie, you know. And, again, it but it's not just blowing smoke either. I think that's kind of where I stick, is that it's not just, you know, it's not all popcorn and bubblegum. It makes you feel good. It affirms you, but then it also says, however, things aren't just because things are worth it and things are, you know, you're just because following your dreams or living out your dreams isn't the wrong thing to do, it doesn't mean that it's the only thing, and it doesn't mean that it's the ultimate thing. And I feel like that's again the balance that it strikes in that ending, which I initially rubbed me the wrong way, but then, you know, the more I think about it, the further away I get from the movie, the more perfect it really is. And just the simple fact that this big technical exercise in many ways ends simply with two close-ups of faces. I feel like that is a testament to the movie that, you know, starts with such a huge musical number and just ends with this quiet little moment. And it says a lot about the power of movies I want to go watch it again right now.
Me too.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.